Church. According to the bulletin, it was Christy down to preach today, so if you're surprised to see me. What happened was midweek last week, Christy fell ill, and in the midst of coughing and wheezing, he asked me if I would speak today. And being the submissive wife that I am, I said yes. Okay, this morning I decided to introduce what I want to speak about with a slide. And, okay. So please, would you turn with me to the book of Ruth? I promise I don't have any more silly slides. Okay. Now, if you're in the book of Ruth, you can take it down. Okay. Now, in our Bibles, the book of Ruth follows immediately after the book of Judges, because the events that take place in the book of Ruth happened during the period that the judges were judging Israel. In fact, when the Bible was printed on scrolls, the book of Judges, the book of Ruth would be attached to the scroll that contained the book of Judges, because it was a very small book. However, in the Jewish Bible, the book of Ruth is categorized with the books that are read during festival days or feast days. Now, the book of Ruth is set between the period 1600 BC to 1100 BC, and there is a great debate about who actually wrote this book down. We know that it's written mainly from Naomi's perspective, but we don't know exactly who the author was. But one thing that we do know is that, unlike the book of Judges, which records or accounts for some of the worst accounts of some of the worst of human nature and depravity, the book of Ruth is about compassion, integrity, and redemption. In fact, the book of Ruth, if you've read the book of Judges and then you read the book of Ruth comes like a breath of fresh air. Now, Ruth chapter 1 opens with the account of a famine. So if you turn your Bibles to Ruth chapter 1, you will see that in the first verses it says that in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Now, this famine was so severe that it affected even the town of Bethlehem. I say that because the name Bethlehem means a house of bread. And the other name for Bethlehem is Ephrathah, which means fruitful. So we see that these names were given to this town because this was an area where the soil was very fertile. However, now we have a famine that is so severe that even the house of bread or this fertile area is affected. And we see that this leads a man named Elimelech to take his family, his wife Naomi, and his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and travel to the land of Moab. Now, as the book of Judges is based in the same period as the events of the Judges, we can infer that this famine was a period where God had lifted his protection and provision so that perhaps there were invasions from foreign armies and there was a lack of food. Do you remember the story of Gideon? Do you remember what happened? The Midianites were coming and attacking them when the harvest was there. So they had no food. So we can infer that this is a period when God, they have sinned and God's protection has been lifted. Now, many commentators disagree about how they view the idea or the fact that Elimelech moved to Moab. Because you see, Numbers 22-25 and Judges 8:12-14 tell us that Moab was a great enemy of Israel. So there are commentators who would say that the tragedies that occurred in Elimelech and Naomi's life was because they had made this decision to go to Moab. However, when you actually look at the text doesn't say either way. But one thing we do know, that this idea or this plan or this action of taking his family to Moab did not result in anything better. Because what happens is in the span of 10 years, both Elimelech and his sons Mahlon and Chilion die. Now, interestingly, the name Mahlon and Chilion mean sickness and wasting. Now, I don't know why these names were given. Was it because at birth these boys were sick and they grew up with sickness? But one thing we do is that they live long enough to get married. They married Moabite women. Mahlon married Ruth, and Kilon married Orpah. But we know, according to chapter 1, that they die leaving their wives widows and childless. Now, the Bible tells me that when God chastises us, it is because he loves me, or he loves you. Because we are his children, because we belong to him. The goal of God's chastisement is to produce righteousness and holiness in us. It is a place where God shines his light on our thinking, our attitudes, and our heart. And this is an important part of the process of sanctification. 1 Corinthians 11:32 says, "But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord, so that we will not be condemned along with the world." Chastisement, therefore, as painful as it may be, is a place of hope, because God is at work. It is a place where I can flee to the loving arms of Jesus, because God is a loving Father who wants the best for me. And the best for me is to be like his son, Jesus. Now we read about Naomi. We see that, you can imagine, she's reeling under this succession of tragedies. First of all, they've moved from her hometown and they've gone to Moab. Then her husband Elimelech dies. Then her sons who have recently married, they die and their wives are childless. And as she reels under this tragedy after tragedy, she makes a decision to go back home. We see that in verse 6. And the decision is because she has heard, in verse 6, when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughter-in-laws prepared to return home from there. But before long, we see that they're on their way to Judah. But before long, we see that Naomi begins to reevaluate the situation. Because in that time, as is the case in many parts of the world even today, if you did not have, as a woman, if you did not have a male protector in the form of a father or a husband or a brother or a son, you were in a very precarious situation where you could be at the mercy of anyone. And so Naomi thinks it would be better off for Orpah and Ruth to go home. And she tries to persuade them. She says, go home back to your families and find rest in the house of a second husband. We see this from verses 8 to 13. I will leave that to you for you to read. And eventually we see that Orpah, she says, I don't want to go. But eventually she agrees and she goes home. But then Ruth, what does Ruth do? She clings to Naomi and she says these iconic words which are recorded in verse 16 to 17. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. You know what Naomi did? She painted a picture so bleak, so dark about the future for her and Orpah and Ruth. But what Ruth does is this. She clings to her Naomi, and in effect, this is what she says. She says, yes, that all may be true. But I am going into that bleak future, that dark future with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Naomi has no hope for herself, very little to give Ruth. In fact, we read that Naomi, in verse 20, it says, Naomi says, don't call me Naomi anymore, because Naomi means pleasant. She says, call me Mara, because of the bitterness of my sorrow. So Ruth does not have an unrealistic or a rose-tinted view of the future. And yet she tells Naomi, I am walking into that uncertain future with you. I will not leave you. In fact, I will embrace it all. Your future, your people, your God. And you know what? I don't know how much Ruth knew about the God of her mother-in-law. But she gets it right when she begins, or she decides to start that journey into an uncertain future with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you know what? She is in the safest place she could ever be. Now, verse 22 records that Naomi and Ruth returned to Bethlehem at the time of the barley harvest. And verse 19c, we see that the whole town was stirred because Naomi had come back. And I read a bit of her response, but this is how she responds as we see in verse 20. She says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but I am returning empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Naomi speaks from the bitterness of her heart, and yet her response is real. And even though she responds in bitterness, she declares a very important truth, that God is sovereign even in our suffering. You know, the God of the Bible is a merciful God who is compassionate, faithful, and slow to anger. And we see that he gives us the space to ask him why. You know, we see that in the Psalms, and the Psalms writers say this, Psalms 10:1, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in time of trouble?" Psalms 42:9, "Why must I go mourning, oppressed by my enemy?" Psalm 74:10, "How long will the enemy mock you, O God?" So God gives us that space. And yet, if I and you were in a place of suffering, pain, and unanswered prayers, and we were knowing and certain and content that God is sovereign and he is good, let me tell you that that is actually a place of great comfort and certainty, no matter what suffering or pain you may be going through. The truth is this, that in spite of all that Naomi has lost, in the midst of her bitter sorrows, God was at work. Just as God is at work in your lives, if you are a child of God, God is at work in your lives, no matter what the suffering may be. In the midst of the worst of circumstances, God is at work. And this is what brings us to chapter 2. We see that life in Bethlehem is not easy for Ruth and Naomi. Their circumstances make them vulnerable. And it is in these circumstances that we begin to see the character of Ruth. Now, verse 2 tells us that Ruth goes to her mother-in-law and she says, ask permission. And she says, I want to go out and I want to pick leftover grain behind the harvesters working in the field. So basically, she would go and pick up grain that the harvesters had left. And this was called gleaning. And verse 6 tells us that she worked from morning until, and only took a short break. You see, Ruth is a woman of diligence. She does not hesitate to face hard work, the hard work needed to look after her mother-in-law. She refuses to eat the bread of idleness and decides to go and work in the fields. Now, according to Levitical law, permission to glean or pick up leftover grain was granted to the foreigner, the poor, the fatherless, and the widow. We see this in Leviticus 19:9. But as you can imagine, this would be dependent on the goodwill of the owner of the field. God's instructions were, do not reap till the edges of your field. Leave it so that the poor or the stranger can pick up grain. And Ruth finds herself in one such field. She goes to the foreman and she says, can I pick up leftover grain? Now, when the Bible speaks of diligence, it talks about diligence primarily in two ways. The Bible talks about diligence in using all that God has given us wisely. We see this in the parable of the talents. And it is the acknowledgement that this is from God, so I want to use it wisely because I will have to give him account. The Bible also speaks about diligence in making our election and calling sure. We do this by choosing to walk day in, day out, day after day, exercising faith. Now, the diligence that Ruth uses here is that she uses all the opportunities that she has to do all that she can so that her mother-in-law and she can be fed. And this is, and I just want to say, it is no mere coincidence that while Ruth is working hard in the field, there is someone far greater who is at work, who is putting his plans into place. Who is this? This is the God who Ruth called her own. And this is why Ruth finds herself working on the field of a man named Boaz. Now, the name Boaz means in him who is strength. The Bible tells us, chapter 2 tells us, he's a rich man of standing. Or some translations will say he's a mighty man of wealth. But most importantly, as you will see in chapter 2, verse 20, he is a kinsman redeemer. Now, who is a kinsman redeemer, or goel, as the Hebrew word says? Now, if we look at Deuteronomy chapter 5 to 10, God had instructed that if a married man died childless, then it was the duty of his brother or his closest male relative to marry the widow. And the firstborn child would carry on the name of the deceased. And we see that this goes on to, you could approach the kinsman redeemer if you were in debt or in trouble. And Ruth finds herself working on Boaz's fields. And this is no coincidence, because God is at work bringing this vulnerable woman who has called the God of Naomi as her own to a place of protection. As vulnerable as she was, Ruth could easily have been exploited. But Boaz instructs her in verse 8 to stay on his fields and to watch the harvesters carefully and keep track of his movements so that she does not end up on someone else's fields. The fields were not divided by fences. They were just sort of pits. You could easily end up on somebody else's field. He then tells her that he has instructed the men not to touch her. In some versions it says, do not molest her. Because this was the sad reality of a woman with no male protector in those days. In fact, her mother-in-law, Naomi, repeats this in verse 22 when she says, don't go to someone else's field because you could get harmed. We also see that Boaz offers her food and drink, and he instructs the harvesters. He says, be kind to her. Don't just let her pick up leftover grain. Take out a stalk from your bundles and leave it so she can take it home. We see that to Ruth's great surprise, Boaz speaks kindly to her. And we see in chapter 2, verse 12, that he even blesses her, saying, this is what he says, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Chapter 3 tells us that Ruth does not, chapter 2 tells us that Ruth does not hide anything from Naomi. We see that Naomi comes up with a plan. Now, Naomi is concerned for Ruth and her future. However, in her desire to provide Ruth with a husband and a future, she comes up with a strategy that is at best odd or strange. Chapter 3 tells us that in her aim to provide Ruth with a husband, she advises Ruth to go and wash herself and perfume herself and wear her best clothes. She says that Ruth, you then need to go to the threshing fold. Wait till Boaz has had enough to drink and eat and fallen asleep, then sneak in and uncover his feet and fall asleep at his feet. Now, if you were reading this passage for the first time, what would you think? You think, and where is this supposed to lead? Now, Naomi's motives may have been sincere, but this was a plan that could go terribly wrong, especially for Ruth, a woman and a foreigner. You see, Boaz could drive Ruth away with moral indignation, or this risky midnight strategy could lead to the violation of God's laws on sexual purity before marriage. So why would Naomi come up with such a strategy? Perhaps she was desperate, and in desperation she thought, this is what I need to do. Or she had implicit trust in Boaz's character not to take advantage of Ruth. So when Boaz's character is put to the test,
How does he come out? What is the outcome? Boaz comes out shining like gold. In rabbinic commentary, Boaz is seen as a hero because of his sexual restraint. We see that not only does he understand Ruth's vulnerability, well, that Ruth is vulnerable, but he chooses to support her and he chooses not to exploit the situation that she is in. In fact, in chapter 3, verse 11, this is what he says to her. I will do for you what you ask. And what did Ruth ask of Boaz? You will see that in verses 8 to 9. So let me read that to you. Chapter 3, verses 8 to 9. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. So she says, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are my kinsman redeemer. Now the term spread the corner of your garment or your skirt over me, and some translations, could be taken as take me as your wife. And we see that this phrase is used in the same context in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy 22:30 and Ezekiel 16:8. We see that if she had, Naomi would be correct in trusting Boaz not to take advantage of Ruth. We see that he treats Ruth with kindness and respect. Naomi had told her, he will tell you what to do. But what does Boaz actually say? He says, I will do for you as you ask. We see that he does not send Ruth empty-handed. He gives her 6 measures of barley. And he is so concerned for her honor and his name that he instructs her to leave before sunrise so no one will see that she has left the threshing floor. Now let me tell you, you only need to read Judges to see that Boaz lived in a time where vulnerability was exploited again and again. It didn't even matter if you had a male protector. If you read the book of Judges, you could be exploited, you could be molested, you could be exploited and even killed. You read the end of Judges, that's what happens. But Boaz was a different man in his time. He was different because he chooses not to exploit his power. You know, today when we live at a time in history where the Me Too movement has taken center stage, the Bible gives us Boaz, a man who chooses not to abuse his power. This is not just a man who does not abuse his power. He's a man who does not even deny or abdicate his power and authority. He recognizes that with his authority comes responsibility, and he uses them well. He fights to give power to the powerless. What a man. I pray that we will bring our sons up to be like Boaz. And I have a son, he's only 2 years old, but that's what I pray for him, that he will be a man who will use his authority, whatever God gives him, well. He will use it well. And I pray that our churches will be places where our men are like Boaz. You know, the world thinks it has all the answers, but actually God has. It's the church that should be setting a standard of what it looks to be like a godly man and a godly woman. Don't let the world set the standards of what it looks like. God, I was reading this and I was saying, God, this is the message for our times. So many centuries past, God gives us the example of Boaz, and his story resonates for us in this century. And this is why Boaz is seen as a forerunner of Jesus, the ultimate kinsman redeemer, the epitome of true manhood, a friend, a brother, and a refuge to the vulnerable. Now you may wonder, why did it take this much time for Boaz to come to the aid of Ruth and Naomi? And I believe chapter 3 gives us 2 clues. Verse 10 tells us, that Boaz, in his own admission to Ruth, he said that he thought of himself as an older man and she was a young widow. And verse 12 tells us, as he explains to Ruth, that there was actually a kinsman redeemer who was closer in relation to Naomi. And so this may be why there was this delay in coming to aid of Naomi and Ruth. And so we see in verses 9 to 10 of chapter 4, that Boaz, he has promised Ruth, he sent her home, and he's promised Ruth that I will do as you ask. And so what he does is he goes to the town gates meanwhile, and he meets with the kinsman redeemer. And you will see that the kinsman redeemer, who is closer in relation to Naomi, he's initially agreeable to buy Naomi's land. But when Boaz tells him that you will also have to marry Naomi, he says, I can't do that because it will be at cost to my own assets. And verse 9 to 10 of chapter 4 tells us that Boaz, then in the presence of the elders, he says that I will marry Ruth. And this is what we do. And later, this is what he does. And later in chapter 4, we see that Ruth and Boaz have a son, and he is named Obed. Now, it's very interesting that in verse 17, the women of the town come to Naomi and say, Naomi has a son. Now, do you remember Naomi's return to Bethlehem? She came back childless and a widow. She came back talking about the bitterness of her sorrow. But all along, God was at work. And he was not just making a plan so that Naomi would see a grandchild or a child who would take on the name of Mahlon. But we see that God was putting in place the plan for the ultimate kinsman redeemer, Jesus. The book of Ruth is definitely a book about two remarkable people. Ruth, verse 17 of chapter 4, says that she was equal. This is in the language of that time. It says that she was equal to seven sons. She was a Moabitess. And this is what's said about Ruth. And it's about another person, Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, whose integrity and compassion shine bright. But I believe and I want to submit to you this morning that the book of Ruth has a much greater message. That it is a message of a merciful God who is working even in the midst of the worst of your circumstances. With God, there is hope in chastisement. With God, even in suffering, we can be assured of his sovereignty and his goodness. And with God, even if the future looks as bleak and dark as Naomi's, we can be comforted that he is at work. He is at work. I have two short sort of examples to give before you. In the book, The Insanity of God, we read about a young Muslim convert, Aisha. And because she has become a Christian, she is arrested and she is taken to the police headquarters. She is then imprisoned in the basement, unfinished basement of the police headquarters. There is no light, there is no heating. And she's there, she's young, she's alone, she doesn't know what the future holds. And as terror and fear begin to oppress her, she's about to scream when instead she begins to sing. And as she sings, she notices that upstairs the movement has stopped. She's sure that they're listening to what she sings. And that evening, the commissioner of the police, he comes down and he says, "What is it with you? You are different. You're not like my mother or my sisters or the other women in my house. They are afraid of everything. You are not afraid. I want you to come home and talk to them about why you are not afraid. And I want you to sing that song." Now, do you think Aisha was not afraid? She was. But there was a greater reality than the reality of that cold, dark basin. That God was in control. And that God was at work. And no matter life or death, God is sovereign and he is good. When I was in my final year at seminary, we had a new librarian. And as I got to know her, I realized she was a Hindu convert. And I spoke to her. She started speaking about her daughter. She said, "My daughter's married and she has a son." And I think a son. And I started speaking about the wedding. And she said, "I didn't attend my daughter's wedding." I said, "Why?" And she said, you know, I was a Hindu, you know, in Hinduism, a widow is seen as bad luck. So I was not allowed to attend my daughter's wedding. And I had never heard of it before, but she spoke about it. And then she talked about her husband dying. And then she turned to me and she said, I miss my husband every day. But it was a good thing that he died. I was a bit shocked. And she said, because if my husband had not died, I would have never come to know Jesus. And as I listened to that, I said, I need to take something from this. Because to her, she loved her husband. She did not know Jesus before because her husband was a great husband. She had no needs. But as that cover was removed, she turned her eyes to Jesus and she found Jesus. You see, God is at work, even in the worst of our circumstances. Naomi was widowed and childless, but God was working in her life, and through Ruth, she became the honorary great-great-grandmother of King David, into whose line the Messiah would be born. We see that he was at work in the life of his people, the people of Israel. He came to their aid and provided them food. But he was also doing something else. They had had judges after judges. Some were great judges, some were not that great. They had Gideon, Samson, Jephthah. But he was preparing the path for the greatest judge of all time, the perfect righteous judge, Jesus, to come. And you know, you may not believe it, but he was actually at work in our lives too. Because through the Messiah born into the lineage of Boaz, like Ruth the Moabitess, who was brought into the family of God, we, who were not the people of God, were brought into his family. So can we live our lives? How can we live our lives with the acknowledgement that God is at work? We can do so by living diligently, which is that we choose to accept that all that we have is from God and we want to use it well. But we can also live in hope. It's about seeing that a bigger picture that God is at work. It would be like going to a charity shop, which I love, and picking up a seashell and putting it next to your ear and immediately being transported to the seashore. To feel the salt in the waves, to hear the roaring waves, and to feel the sand slip through your hands. It's about seeing. This may be what it is, but there is something far beyond. No matter what your battles are today, the truth remains unchanged. If you are a child of God, if you have chosen to come into his family, God is at work. No matter what today looks like for you. You know, I want to leave you with Boaz's words to Ruth when he blesses her in chapter 2, verse 12. He says, may you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And if you are a person who doesn't know the comfort of those wings, if you are new to this God, can I invite you? Can I invite you to find refuge in his wings, under his wings? And if you are a person who knows the comfort of his wings, I don't know what your pressures are today, what your struggles are. Perhaps you're going through a period of chastisement. Perhaps you're going through a period of trials. Whatever it may be, may I invite you to find refuge under the wings of a God who is always on your side, working for you, for your good, always. God bless you.